A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Political Currency
with Ed Balls and George Osborne.
So we're back and we are remote this week. Looking behind you, George, the busts on display makes me think this is not your normal office.
Yeah, these we should say for people who can't see the pictures, these are Roman and Greek busts rather than any other kind. And these are the ones that are in the British Museum, where I'm chairing a board meeting later today. And everything is safe and sound here, I can report.
So those aren't busts that you've had to recover in your trawling around the world to kind of find the lost treasures?
These aren't the ones that were nicked. We actually have on display here a very good exhibition of some of the things that were nicked, if people want to come and see for free, which we've recovered. And we've put they're more like glass gems that were from the Roman and Greek period, which are on display just off the entrance hall. You know, new era of transparency and all that. Talking about the era of transparency, how are you getting on with your band after we discovered that Robert Peston isn't as collegiate a band member as I thought he might be?
Look, we are back in the studio Saturday morning, so all is fine. I actually had a text. I told people that they should listen to our podcast and sent round this cutting about how Charlie Watts, the drummer of the Rolling Stones, told Mick Jagger that if he referred to him again as your drummer, he was going to punch him, just to sort of make sure Robert was on his toes. But then Robert responded to say, I haven't heard it, but Osborne told me he was going to wind Ed up. And I had to break it to him that I wasn't wound up at all. I'm just a drummer. Just a drummer.
Just a tiny bit wound up, maybe.
No, I'm not wound up at all. In any way.
I'll tell you who is wound up. So there's a guy called Rupert Harrison, who was my chief of staff, very bright guy. He is standing to be the Tory MP for Woodstock in Oxfordshire. And it turns out your band is called, as I understand it, Centrist Dad.
That's right.
But he is already in a band that predates yours that is called Centrist Dads. I mean, why both of you think that it's sexy for pop stars to be Centrist Dads, I don't know. But anyway, he thinks you've nicked his band title.
Well, look, if they want to be the other Centrist Dad, that's fine. I would offer to change the name. But as you know, George, I'm just the drummer. So it's nothing to do with me. Peston's in charge.
He's got to make the call.
He chooses the name.
The Mick Jagger of this outfit needs to make the decision on whether the world's big enough for two Centrist Dads.
Meanwhile, I'm reeling from Good Morning Britain this week because I ended up in a bit of a media storm on Tuesday morning because we were reporting the likely next James Bond, and the guy tipped to get the job, a young actor called Aaron Taylor-Johnson, and I just said off the cuff, fine, but look at his hair. I mean, it was shoulder length. And I said, you know, if he's going to be James Bond, he'll have to get his hair cut. And people went bonkers. You know, who is Ed Balls? Who does he think he is? James Bond doesn't have to look a particular way. Doesn't he know you can have a haircut? I mean, it was first time I've actually seen the James Bond fan machine. It went into total overdrive.
Yeah, but hold on. He's called Commander Bond, isn't he? I mean, he is actually in the Royal Navy,
exactly.
I believe. So I don't think the Royal Navy have become so woke that you can have, you know, a ponytail on board HMS whatever.
That was my view. The thing which was a bit shocking then, it was then reported in the Times the next day that Aaron Taylor-Johnson is now pulled out of being the next Bond.
Because your didn't fault.
He didn't want to get involved. Us. He didn't want to get involved in the celebrity media circus. I don't think it could have been me.
No.
It must have been a contractual negotiation.
Of course, you would, you know, there's a lot of speculation about you. You would announce you're pulling out of the contest to be the next Bond anyway, because if they pick you, you can say, oh, well, actually, I was misleading you. I am going to be the next Bond and no one would care. They'd move straight on.
When
so
you
it's
say
actually
you,
sensible media management.
Yeah, but when you say you, you don't mean me.
Well,
because I've not put my name in and I'm not expecting the call.
Yeah. Well, you know, you were pretty lethal when you were facing me. I always felt you had a license to kill, a license you've given yourself.
Look.
Anyway, given, let's move on to more important matters, which are the events of this week.
Well, first of all, you said a week ago that sometimes governments get into a spiral where they sort of suddenly lose control of the agenda. And that was picked up over the weekend in the newspapers. George Osborne says government in a spiral. And we thought we'd start by talking about a week on, at the end of a week in which Rishi Sunak started by doing an economy speech to say we're bouncing back, whether he's got the right strategy to stop this spiral and turn things around.
And then we're going to turn our attention to the long lecture, the MACE lecture it's called, that Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, delivered this week about what Labour would do if they had their hands on the economy and what the lessons from history are about what they're planning.
And then we're going to talk about conscription, not something we've seen in our country for, I don't know, 60 years, more than that. But a number of European countries, more than I realise, still have conscription where 18-year-olds are required to be called up for the armed forces. And we saw last weekend the Latvian foreign minister saying that if Britain is a serious player in protecting the NATO countries from Russian aggression, that Britain should think about a return to conscription. And we're going to talk about whether that is really on the agenda for the UK in the coming years, whether that's likely to happen. But first of all, spirals. I looked at Rishi Sunak this week and I thought to myself, he was definitely doubling down. He wasn't giving any ground to his critics, even though you had a weekend last weekend of Penny Mordaunt supporters apparently saying she was ready for a leadership bid, although she's completely denied that. It was very much sticking to the plan, carry on, bouncing back. Is it going to work?
I think he's actually had a better week than last week when we did the podcast, because things have been relatively stable and he's had some good economic news on his central economic pledge, which is to get inflation down. And inflation fell to 3.4%. And we're recording this before the Bank of England makes any decision. We're not expecting them to cut rates, but everyone's expecting rates to start to fall soon. So the economic situation is improving. I thought the political situation was a bit calmer than it was last week when we had, for example, Lee Anderson defecting and all this speculation about Penny Mordaunt wielding her sword. But Sunak still got this problem, which is he's way behind in the polls. People are talking about his leadership. And the spiral I referred to, just for those who didn't hear it, is that, you know, in politics, kind of failure breeds failure, i.e., you know, if you're behind in the polls, if you're a weak government, if people are speculating about your leadership, it becomes harder to do things and that makes you look weaker. And then that contributes to your problem. So you sort of go down in a spiral. You can also have an upward spiral, which is if people think you're doing well, if people think you're winning, they give you the benefit of the doubt. Your mistakes are ignored and the things that you happen to get right are amplified as great kind of acts of strategic genius. And so Sunak has been in one of these spirals, but they're not irreversible. And you and I have seen through our own political careers the kind of ebb and flow of when you're up and when you're down. And I thought, your suggestion, it would be a good idea, wouldn't it, to go through some of the things that you can do to try and recover the situation. That's what Sunak, I guess, was trying to achieve this week. Perhaps we should just hear him talking about his bounce back, or rather the economy's bounce back.
The last couple of years have clearly been difficult, not just for the UK, but we've dealt with COVID, recovering from COVID, then we got hit by a war in Ukraine and the impact on energy bills. But I do believe that at the start of this year, we have turned a corner after the shocks of the past few years, and we are in a new economic moment, and 2024 will prove to be the year that the economy bounces back.
In a private meeting with Tory MPs, the 1922 committee meeting, he actually directly address the fact that what he called a very small number of Conservative MPs were speculating about his leadership. And he essentially made another unite or die speech to MPs, which got everyone banging their desks, as those speeches always do. So, Ed, you know, you look at this with a bit more distance than I do. How do you think he's doing? And should we go through some of the things you would recommend and I would recommend he should at least consider?
It's interesting because when you said the thing about spiral, it made me think of the Barack Obama, the first of his presidential biographies, A Promised Land. Interesting because Barack Obama, we now know, was in seeing Rishi Sunak in Downing Street this week. And I wondered whether he brought a copy of this book because there's a chapter called In the Barrel. And it totally speaks to what we're talking about here. He says, it's in the nature of politics and certainly the presidency to go through rough patches. But if the rough patch lasts long enough, you may find yourself in a dreaded situation in which problems compound, then congeal into a broader narrative. The negative stories don't let up. Your political adversaries smell blood. The press starts digging. And he says, until, like the daredevils and fools of old at Niagara Falls, you find yourself trapped in the proverbial barrel, tumbling through the crashing waters, bruised and disorientated, no longer sure which way is up, powerless to arrest your descent, waiting to hit bottom and hoping without evidence you'll survive the impact. That is a spiral he talks about. But when you then read this kind of long, I have to say, in my view, rather rambling chapter, it's a very long biography Barack Obama wrote, you sort of start to see what he thinks you need to do. And if you ever listen, there's a really good podcast called Pod Save America, in which Obama former advisors talk about politics. What they say the Obama strategy was never to simply say, plow on, keep falling, just hope it'll all be okay, fight back, be defiant. That the thing that Obama always wanted to do was to acknowledge to the media, okay, things haven't worked. There's reasons why they haven't worked. We're now changing things around. We're going to change our style or our personnel or our strategy. In that key period when he got into trouble in his first term around the midterms, he did shift away from the economy being his central narrative, changed some personnel, started to really drive new legislation in Congress. And that the thing you have to do is say to the press, OK, you've given me a hard time. I'm changing. Judge me now on whether the change works. And unless you do that, you just can't break the narrative. It's not enough to say it's working, we're bouncing back, I'm ploughing on. You have to sort of acknowledge and then shift. And that is not what Rishi Sunak has been doing in the last week. He is still very much in the, it's going to work, stick with me, I'm not changing, it will all come right. And the question is, in this kind of spiral, I mean, I think if Obama was with Rishi Sunak this week, he may have been saying to him, it's not going to work. You need to change strategy in a more fundamental way.
So are you saying you should openly admit that you have got a problem, a political problem? In other words, if you don't, I think you get this problem of authenticity. You know, you're interviewed on all these regional tours. So Rishi Sunak's been in the West Country and, you know, he's popped up on in Gloucestershire on campaigning visits. And when he's asked, he says, I'm 100% focused on, the plan. I'm not listening to any of this gossip. And then, the moment he gets back in the car, he'll be straight on the phone to his chief whip or his senior political advisor. And he'll be like, what's the latest on Penny Mordaunt's manoeuvres? What are we going to do? And people aren't stupid. They know that's the case. So are you saying that you should sort of publicly acknowledge you have party management issues, and by acknowledging them, you can, basically engage credibly with the public in how you're going to respond?
Well, see, I think that the Obama argument is that unless you do that in some way, the press will never give you a new chance for reassessment because they just see what you're doing is more of the same. If you take Tony Blair in the autumn of 2004 into 2005, it had been a really torrid year after Iraq. The polls were not good. He'd sort of tried to turn things around. He'd actually thought about standing down as prime minister. But then he did two things. First of all, he decided to go out there and do a, look, I'm going to talk to the public and hear what they say and let them tell me all the things I've got wrong. It was almost like a masochist strategy. Okay, if it's not worked, tell me why and let me do better. And then he also had that big moment in the spring where he brought Gordon Brown back slightly from the wilderness of the autumn and said, we are restoring the duopoly, the partnership. It led to the famous ice cream moment in the election campaign, but Gordon was also brought back in to run the campaign. That was a deliberate strategy from Blair to say, it's not just more of the same. I'm acknowledging not everything's gone well. I'm listening and I'm changing.
I mean, the culmination of this approach that Tony Blair took in 2004-05, which was, you know, acknowledging Iraq was deeply divisive and actually going out of his way to, for example, meet the families of soldiers who had been killed, enabled him to win the election in 2005. And this is what he said immediately after winning on the steps of Downing Street.
In addition, I know that Iraq has been a deeply divisive issue in this country. That's been very, very clear. But I also know and believe that after this election, people want to move on. They want to focus on the future in Iraq and here.
That is a different strategy from what we've seen in the last week from Rishi Sunak, where he's saying, you know, stick with me. It's bouncing back. It is going to turn. Gordon Brown in January 2010, if you remember the sort of failed Hewitt coup, but there was a problem. Gordon Brown had the same problem in 2008, the failed David Miliband coup. Both times, he did shift the narrative. He brought back Peter Mandelson in the first case. He talked about doing things in a more collegiate way, bringing Harriet Harman and Jack Straw more into the decision-making. Whether it was real or not is another matter. The strategy was to say, I'm listening, I'm shifting, I'm going to do things in a different way. I remember 2010 really well because I sort of got it in the neck. Quite a lot of the briefing was, you know, Ed Ball's being pushed aside. We're doing things in a different way. Gordon, as always, said, I don't know where these stories come from, Ed. I don't know why they write these things. But, you know, there we are. If you remember, Ed Miliband tried the same as well, which didn't work when he had the problems with Image, the bacon sandwich. And he did a, you know, if you want the guy from Central Casting, I'm not the right one. I don't think he really did do any kind of change at that point. But he tried to be a bit sort of a Obama-y, you know, I'm shifting to a different phase.
Yeah, I think so. Those are all examples. I mean, famously, Brown said, didn't he, it's no time for a novice, which was a dig at, ostensibly a dig at David Cameron, but really a dig at David Miliband.
Yeah.
So in all of those cases, there are people who sort of acknowledge they've got a problem. And that buys you at least some time, because in many of these cases, it doesn't ultimately work for them. But it does sort of reset the media narrative. And again, you're talking about the issue that everyone else is talking about. And that gives you credibility instead of pretending it's not happening.
You test it on a different metric. The metric becomes, is your new strategy going to work rather than is the old strategy going to eventually work?
It's interesting. This week, Sunak said privately, as we mentioned to Tory MPs, that there was a problem with some of them plotting against him. But he hasn't said anything publicly. And I would say throughout his premiership, one of his mistakes has been not to acknowledge that, you know, he resigned from the Boris Johnson government because he was not happy with the Boris Johnson government. He should say that again and again and again. He stood against Liz Truss because he didn't think her economic policies were credible. He should say that again and again. He's so worried about, you know, reigniting the Tory civil war that he doesn't notice, or he certainly does notice, but he's allowed the civil war to be ignited without necessarily sort of taking a strong position in it. And I think it'd be very much to his credit to say, look, there are some people in the party who don't like what I'm doing, don't like the way I'm leading it, fine. But I tell you what, the way I'm doing it is moral, it's economically competent, it's going to deliver the results from Britain. And if they don't like it, they can either put up or shut up. And I think that would, people would like a bit of a flash of steel. Which brings you to this sort of other thing, which is, you say, change the personnel, which is what Gordon Brown did when he brought Peter Mandelson, you know, who everyone thought he sort of completely fallen out with, back as Deputy Prime Minister. And you mentioned Tony Blair bringing kind of Gordon Brown back into the fold when he handed him that ice cream somewhere in Kent, didn't he? Should Sunak at this point be kind of having a reshuffle? He's only months away from this general election. Or is that, you know, just going to cause more trouble?
The radical thing to do is to say, OK, let's decide who's going to be the leader, to do as John Major did in 1995, the sort of put up or shut up moment. But short of that, he could say...
We should remind people of that moment. This was, by the way, for those who, you know, aren't as old as us listening, John Major, you know, was facing a huge amount of speculation about his leadership in the run-up to the 97 election. Very similar situation, way behind the polls, looked like Labour were going to win. And rather than wait to be challenged for the Tory leadership, he himself resigned the Tory leadership, remained Prime Minister, but resigned as Tory leader and said, I'm entering a new contest to be the Tory leader and let's see who can challenge me. And ultimately, John Redwood did. But this is the moment when he issued the famous challenge.
The Conservative Party must make its choice. Every leader is leader only with the support of his party. That is true of me as well. That is why I'm no longer prepared to tolerate the present situation. In short, it is time to put up or shut up.
The thing is that they'd only changed the leader once in the previous few years for Margaret Thatcher in 1990, and he still had 2 years left of the parliament. If I were Rishi Sunak, I mean, look, not only did that not work for John Major, but if you've already had multiple changes of leader and you've only got 6 months left, I'm not sure that's a wise strategy. But it doesn't have to be only the leader which changes personnel-wise. You could say part of my change is reshaping my team. I mean, that is an option for him.
I mean, the interesting thing is he's got quite a lot of cabinet ministers who people think aren't going to be cabinet ministers, even if, you know, if Sunak wins. And so you could put in place your fresh young team who is going to carry on after the election. I mean, I remember we made a kind of difficult decision in the run-up to the 2015 election. William Hague, you know, was a very close friend of mine, still is, close friend of David Cameron's, had been a key political ally. You know, we were a triumvirate at the top of the government. He said, I want to step down from Parliament in 2015. I strongly tried to persuade him not to. Indeed, I offered to swap jobs there and then from Chancellor to Foreign Secretary, if that would persuade him to stay. But you know, he made his mind up, and those who know William know that he just, you know, once he's decided on something, he sticks to it. But at that point, David said, as a result, I need to move you out of Foreign Secretary because I need a team that's going to look at the 2015 election like the team who will carry on afterwards rather than the retiring team. And it would be very kind of ballsy of Sunak, but he could shake up his cabinet and say, this is the team that's going to be governing the country in 2025-26.
I've also got a fabulously nerdy thing to put to you. This is an article in the Journal of Social and Political Psychology by Joachim Aidenfalk and Stuart Woodcock, who write about the Australian experience, an article, I'll Be Back, The Chance of a Political Comeback as Party Leader. And they conclude from their study, the major leaders who succeed tend to acknowledge successes due to the collective group, while the party leaders who don't succeed tend to attribute successes to themselves and failures on external factors, including their own collective group. So to succeed, you have to say, you have to double down on what we have achieved together and not spend a lot of time telling everybody else who else's fault it is. I wonder which side of that fence Rishi Sunak's falling on.
Well, yes, I mean, I'm sure he is very frustrated and blaming a load of people for what's going wrong. But ultimately, he's the only person who can fix it because he's the Prime Minister and, you know, he's the one who has the most vested in winning the election. So we're saying, you know, you could change the personnel. We're a bit sceptical of the put up or shut up strategy at this point. It's too close to the general election. We definitely think he should kind of acknowledge he's got a struggle on, but therefore be the fighter in the struggle. I think the final thing, which is much easier said than done, but when I've got myself into kind of big political down spirals, I mean, I had a, you know, one in 2008 because of the, you know, yachts and Corfu and all that. I just learnt the hard way, but it was very useful for later on when I became Chancellor, for example, in 2012, when things weren't doing well, that you can't bounce out of these problems and these spirals immediately. You keep looking for the kind of the exit door that's going to give you an immediate quick win and immediately turn the situation around. That is not how it works. You've got to get the spiral working the other way. And the nature of a spiral is it's slow and it crawls upwards if it's an upward spiral. And so I would say he's got to do fewer things better. He's got to, you know, clear out his week. If I was in Downing Street, I'd look at this grid and say, we've made a whole load of assumptions about things we're going to do with him over the next few weeks. But the truth is, he's behind the polls. There's a lot of speculation about the leadership. So let's stop doing these things that he is not going to be able to deliver anymore. If he does, he's just going to be asked about the leadership. Or, you know, the government's not strong enough at the moment to insist on. And let's focus on the few things we can get done well. And to my mind, I know I'm going to sound like a crack record again, but you've got to focus on the economy. The inflation numbers this week were the best thing that happened for the government. And clear out everything else. Keep the visits to a minimum. Make sure every appearance is well thought through. And come back, as we've said again and again on the show, to being authentic. You know, call out the problems. Don't pretend everything's going hunky-dory when everyone knows it isn't. But own the conversation.
There was this story in Huffington Post this week. Rishi Sunak scored a massive own goal with embarrassing ex-post about football. And it was a post on Twitter from Number 10, graphic of Rishi Sunak holding a football, captioned top bins, Rishi won European Super League nil. I mean, they don't need to try and make Rishi Sunak the guy who's defeated the European Super League. Leave that to Lucy Fraser. The thing he should be doing is doubling down on the collective achievement of the last few years, which is turning the economy around. You're absolutely right. And this week we had a 10-minute speech on Monday. It wasn't enough. He's actually got to go out there and sell the economic message daily.
It was billed as a big economic speech and turned out to be only 10 minutes in Gloucestershire somewhere.
I know. I would acknowledge there's too much noise and distraction and double down on my big achievement and say I'm turning it around.
What about Rwanda, though? Because he has suffered defeats in the House of Lords. It's coming back to the House of Commons. It's going to dominate politics after Easter. Maybe he's in too deep on that now, because to abandon that would be fatal.
I've always worried that if waiting times are high, picking a fight with the doctors isn't going to work. And if people are worried about what's happening in the Channel, picking a fight with the House of Lords and the judges isn't going to work. What people want is to see that the strategy is actually working in terms of waiting times and in terms of the border. And anybody who thinks in Number 10, a fight about Rwanda legislation is going to work well with the public. I mean, the polls say it's not. I never felt it was the right strategy.
I've got one crazy idea to leave you with on this section, which is I think he should announce the date of the general election this autumn. So I think he should say, let's say, November the 14th, which I've speculated might be the date. But whatever it is, whether it's in October, which Jeremy Hunt was hinting at this week, or December, or even in January, although he said it wouldn't be, I would today say, I'll tell you when the general election is going to be. It's going to be on this date. And that ends all the speculation about early elections. It means you don't go through the whole summer with, like, is it going to be October or November? The marginal advantage he's going to get by having a bit of a surprise that it's late October or mid-November or early December is more than outweighed by the endless speculation. And the only reason people know he isn't calling an election right now is because he couldn't win it because he's behind in the polls. So it's not like it looks like the Prime Minister's been classed.
Does it kill the leadership speculation as well?
Yes, it probably does. It's a return to something that I was involved in, which was the Fixed-Term Parliament Act, which, you know, Tories were thrilled to get rid of. But I can tell you, it would be wonderful at the moment for the Tory party if the Fixed-Term Parliament Act had been kept on the statute book and they hadn't got rid of it. Rishi Sunak would be able to say, look, I'll tell you when the general election is. It's going to be in January 2025 because that's our fixed term. And, you know, stop asking me about a May election or a June election or an October election. Anyway, rather foolishly, they got rid of the Fixed-Term Parliament Act, in my view. But as I say, it's a bit of an outlandish idea, but I think it would work. You fix the date now, you end the speculation, you forestall any leadership contest, and you're back in charge of events.
Interesting. So anyway, acknowledge things have got to change, double down on the collective achievement, which is the economy, and talk about it all the time. The irony is this week, it's felt that Labour was talking about the economy just as much as the government, the Rachel Reeves Mays lecture, and that's what we're going to talk about next.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more.
That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back. So Rachel Reeves gave a very long speech this week called the Mace Lecture, which is a lecture named after a former Lord Mayor of London. I have to confess, Ed, I looked that up. I didn't know that, even though I have myself delivered the Mace Lecture. Anyway, it's a lecture that various chancellors and shadow chancellors and the like, and prime ministers even, and governors of the Bank of England had delivered.
Not all shadow chancellors.
I was going to ask you, I mean, Annalise Dodds was asked to give this, which, and she, you know, might be a nice person, but she's definitely a good kind of pub quiz question, like who was Keir Starmer's first shadow chancellor. But, you know, even she got to give them the Mace. How come the great Ed Balls, Professor Balls, was never asked?
I know. The Mace Lecture is my British Davos, something to which I was never invited in that period. The Osborne Cameron Clegg vice-like grip on the economic establishment and narrative left no room for us to get into the Mace Lecture. Never asked. I did my lectures at Bloomberg and at Reuters.
It's not the same thing.
I never did it.
For those who don't know, it's just partly because Nigel Lawson gave a very famous Mace Lecture in 1984. I think ever since then, it's kind of held some kind of mystique. So Rachel gives this speech. And how do you think she'll be thinking about the reception?
I think she will think she had a brilliant Mace Lecture. The truth was, it didn't really have a big detailed policy announcement in it. It was much more about philosophy and direction. And, you know, the criticism of her and Keir Starmer over the last year, we've said this a few times, is that they're not talking enough about growth, which is the biggest challenge of our time, to revive growth, to break out of the fiscal straitjacket. And she managed to do a speech which splashed the Daily Telegraph on her plans for economic growth. She's going to strengthen the growth unit at the heart of the Treasury. A lot of coverage. I would say more impact than Tony Blair had with his Mace Lecture in 1995, Gordon Brown after the election. Probably a bigger impact than the George Osborne Mace Lecture. I think she'd be really pleased with how it's landed, because people were talking about the Rachel Reeves vision for growing the British economy.
I mean, partly, of course, I remember this in early 2020, when I was absolutely thrilled to be able to deliver it. It's a kind of validation that people think you're going to become the Chancellor, and that helps you a lot politically.
What are you trying to say, George?
That it was almost a sure thing by then.
No, but you're saying in my case.
Oh, well, yeah. You're the one who wants to return to the scratch the wound.
I know. I'm just sort of feeling a bit flagellatory. I was having a whiplash moment. Sorry, move on.
You need to move on. But so she gives a long speech. It gets a good write-up. It's, you know, treated seriously, which is obviously what she would want. However, does it really amount to a coherent economic vision? And the heart of what she's saying, the kind of buzzword she is using, is this phrase, securonomics. Here's her talking at the Mace Lecture earlier this week.
The reality is we are already stumbling blindfolded into an era of a bigger state. The unavoidable corollary of sticking plaster politics. The inevitable response when disruption hits an economy with depleted resilience. Inadequately prepared for shocks, its public services overstretched, its government unprepared. Securonomics advances not the big state, but the smart and strategic state.
So what does she mean by securonomics?
I think she's saying there is a more active role for the state, the Treasury and the industry department in shaping which sectors will be central to our economic future. So it's a more hands-on plan for which parts of the economy should be supported to grow. And she's also saying that there should be a priority given to those industries being located, potentially owned here in the UK. It's not an open globalist vision. She's very at pains in the speech to say this is not protectionist. But of course, the question will be, you know, if you are having that strategic view with an eye on securing UK capacity, whether that means you'll be using economic or trade or wide industrial levers to favour British companies or in particular sectors. And
I mean, I agree, absolutely. I mean, that's the sort of big shift from the economic consensus of the sort of Thatcher period and beyond, the Blair Brown and then the Cameron period. I mean, you could argue it was underway anyway post-Brexit with various Tory governments talking about investing in industry sectors, and now we don't have the European rules that stop government intervening, preventing.
And she would say climate change requires you to go down that road, but maybe also worries about supply chain vulnerability to China means that you sort of need to drive a diversity in where you bring goods from around the world. You don't want to be too dependent for a particular commodity or product on countries which could end up being antagonistic towards you. But that, as you say, that's a different philosophy than what we've seen in recent decades.
Yeah, so Securenomics is about supply chain. It's about domestic industry rather than, you know, an open economy. I guess she's also hoping people will think she's secure with the public finances. She's also, I think, making a particular point which she gets onto in the speech, and which we haven't heard so much about in the political debate, but I suspect we will before the election, around people's employment security, their workers' rights. Maybe we should take each in turn. Let's do the money, let's do industry, and let's do workers' rights. On the money, I mean, for all the kind of Labour criticism that the Tories have run down public services and the like, you know, her fiscal rules, which she sets out in this speech again, which is to balance the budget, balance the current budget, i.e. money you're not spending on capital projects, but day-to-day spending, and to get debt falling at the end of 5 years, so that includes capital spending, that's A, almost identical to the current Conservative government, and B, doesn't really, we've been talking on this podcast before about headroom in the fifth year, right? At the moment, doesn't give her any room to go and spend any more money, really, including on capital projects, which she makes a big virtue of in their speech.
It's true. She wants to say, I'm guaranteeing stability. So she's guaranteeing central bank independence, guaranteeing the Office for Budget Responsibility's role, guaranteeing sound fiscal rules. And that's important reassurance. I think she's doing that very well. What she can't do is break out of the current fiscal debate. So we've, you know, talked about the budget and Jeremy Hunt's projections and whether his public spending plans really add up and how they'd be delivered. But as you know, it's very hard to take that argument on from opposition. And she's not seeking to do so. So she's saying, I'm going to balance the current budget, I'll have debt falling. And then she says, I'll grow the economy to deliver the revenues for the future, which is, of course, long-term, exactly the right thing to do. But it doesn't help you with your first budget. But, you know, that is the nature of our politics. We don't have an American, you know, congressional budget debate type approach. The government sets the frame. Any deviation from the government's plans are seen as extra borrowing for spending or taxes. If Jeremy Hunt wants to cut national insurance in his budget, he borrows more, and he's allowed to do that because he's the chancellor. But if you're the shadow chancellor, anything you say which is a deviation from the government's plans is extra borrowing, and she doesn't want to be kind of giving an inch on that. I think she's probably doing what both you and I would do in the same position, but it sort of it doesn't feel as though it solves the fundamental cross-party fiscal challenge our country's facing at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I switched from matching your plans to saying that I would spend less, but it was pretty fierce in the general election as a result in 2010. And there are certainly those who believe that it had an impact on the number of seats we won, although I would say it gave us permission to do everything that happened after the election. But let's park that for a moment. That
thanks to the Lib Dems.
Well, we're always grrateful to President Clegg. So there's this sort of, you know, she's not, you know, she says, I've got a brand new economic vision, but by the way, I'm not going to spend any more money. So that's the first thing. So that's not going to be different. Then she says on industrial policy, I mean, here she has, I mean, I don't really want to bring this up because I know, you know, she used to be in your team and maybe you think she's a bit of a protege, but she had a bit of a pop at, I thought, the Ed Balls record, because she says, you know, that New Labour and the city ministers, Mr. Eballs, left our financial services unregulated, or certainly underregulated, and that led to the financial crash. I mean, that sounded a bit like the argument I used to deploy against you.
No, actually, George, you used to say that we were overregulating our financial services industry in 2005 and 2006 and 2007. We were stifling growth and innovation by excessive regulation, and then there was a financial crash, and then you switched to the other argument. I kind of,
okay,
you know,
well, she's using Osborne Mark II against you.
It's impossible to look back and say that we in Britain or in France or Germany, any place around the world, got regulation of financial services right, because there was a massive financial crash. I don't think that was a New Labour failure. It happened in right of centre and left of centre.
Come on, she puts this in the speech knowing it's going to be written up, as it was, for those who saw it in the newspapers, as an attack on New Labour's light touch approach to city regulation.
See, it's interesting. That is not the bit which I thought was the attack. I thought the attack was that they believe that delivering stability in the economy and making work pay would be enough, and didn't do enough to strengthen the underlying industrial base of the economy. And I think that partly kind of underestimates the scale of the challenge we had in 1997. It's easy now to say, after the last couple of years with Sunak and Hunt, after the aberration of Liz Truss, that she's locking in stability. In 1997, you'd had the ERM crisis, the Lawson boom. There was no independent Bank of England. There was no fiscal rules. There was no independent audit. At the time, instability was the biggest problem the British economy was facing. And we had to say, not only we'd lock it in, but that we would deliver it. And that was the starting economic mission of that period. We also then did important stuff around science and universities, regional development agencies, skills, innovation. But the truth is, we didn't do enough. We certainly didn't do enough in terms of either scale or engaging with regional economies. So hands up. But I don't think I think it underestimates the nature of the challenge in 1997 to say, well, you know, stability in the macro framework was the easy bit. I mean, actually, it was really hard.
I detect in you a bit of scepticism, which certainly I have, that all this talk of a kind of new industrial policy is really going to work. That government has the levers to deliver what she wants, and which no one would really want to argue with, which is, of course, we want a more productive economy and we, you know, want more homegrown industries and so on. Sure. I mean, I thought it was interesting, you know, we're talking about the New Labour period. She's actually harking back, I thought, to Harold Wilson, right back in the early 60s, by the way. There'd been a long period of Tory government. And you get this, in fact, rather dry civil servant, Harold Wilson, coming in. Keir Starmer's a civil servant. He was director of public prosecutions. And, you know, he gave his famous speech. I think it was at the Labour conference, wasn't it? The white heat of the technological revolution. We should come on. It's a good excuse to play that. Probably one of the most famous lines in the last 100 years of British politics.
The Britain that is going to be forged in the white heat of this revolution will be no place for restrictive practices or for outdated methods on either side of industry.
See, I think the interesting thing there, by the way, that sounded like William Hague. I mean, you know, it was Harold Wilson. Could have been William Hague.
William Hague does sound identical to Harold Wilson. They grew up very close to each other in Yorkshire. And it's that, you know, nasal sound, the white heat of the technological revolution. Save the pound under William Hague.
I thought the interesting thing about that clip, which you didn't hear in Rachel Reeves's speech, was that emphasis on restrictive practices. And I think if there was one element where I would have said to her, do more in the speech, it's one thing to say that we need to work to create the conditions for industry to grow and flourish. And I think one of her answers, by the way, on finance, implicit in the speech, is we may not have lots of public money, but we're going to do what it takes to lever in the private money in these key sectors in order to drive growth. And she also wants to talk about working with industry and different councils. But the thing which was really central, I think, in the New Labour period, in our vision, in the Brown vision, was also a challenge to incumbent industry through competition policy, tough competition policy, independent competition policy, opening markets, saying entry is the key. In economics, we would call it Schumpeterian. Schumpeter was the guy who said, the Austrian economist.
Creative destruction.
Creative destruction. You need to have that sort of dynamism. Don't work with the incumbents. Make the space for the new guys to come in. And actually, Wilson's rhetoric about restrictive practices was kind of in that tenor. I'm not sure he did much about it when he was actually prime minister. If I was to say one thing to Rachel, I would be also wanting to open up markets more to have the challenge of entry to incumbents.
We're going the other way. I mean, by the way, not just under a future Labour government, if there is one, but under this Conservative government. I mean, it's, you know, national security considerations are trumping all sorts of things we'd accepted in a previous era were opened for overseas investment.
When she says This is not protectionist. I think she's right. She doesn't want to put up trade barriers, but you also need to have a competition and a regulatory authorities which are breathing down the necks of the incumbents and challenging them to not have restrictive practices or barriers to entry. And I don't think that that is contrary to the Securenomics philosophy. And I would, if I were her, pump that up a bit.
I'm not sure I agree with you, because I think, you know, there's a lot of talk of national champions in this age of great power politics and protectionism and Trump making America great again and Bidenomics. And, you know, national champions don't necessarily thrive when there's lots of competition. I mean, by the way, I'm on the competition side of the argument rather than the national champion side of the argument. Well, we should just touch on one other final element of her speech before moving on, which is, you know, she talked a lot about workers' rights. And if you look at people who say Labour don't have specific policies, they have a quite lengthy plan for reinstating a whole load of trade union rights that were removed over the last 14 years and giving workers extra powers to, for example, say, well, you know, in this age of online working, you can't ask me to do anything after 5 p.m. And, you know, industry is feeling a bit cowed at the moment, partly because their main trade body, the CBI, you know, entirely its own fault, but such a difficult time over recent years. And partly because people think Labour are probably going to win. So industry's been quite quiet at the moment. But there's a lot of concern out there that these are essentially a return to a much more restricted labour market. And things like banning 0 hours contracts might sound like a good thing when you do it as a slogan, but it's actually the basis upon which so many industries operate now. And by the way, so many people happily live their lives. So I think you're going to get a lot more attention on this so-called workers' rights. You could, if you're an effective Tory attack operation, and we've talked about how that operation has actually improved quite dramatically in Downing Street in recent months, as you saw with the attack on the £28 billion spending plan she had. I think this is going to be turned by the Tories into a job-destroying plan under Labour.
Look, I think you are right that all of that was a reaffirming of existing policy, in some ways the doubling down on that New Deal for Working People agenda was the most significant part of the May's lecture from Rachel Reeves. They've done the U-turn on £28 billion. They're not going to do a U-turn on workers' rights, even though there's clearly been some voices internally saying, should we get off this? And they're going to say that Securenomics means that you shouldn't have to wait 6 months to get paternity leave or maternity leave or sickness pay, and a labour market in which people can get sacked after a few months and rehired to avoid those rights is not fair. But there was, I think, a caveat, which is quite important in the small print, which is when they're talking about unfair dismissal, rights from day one, they do say in the briefing, and this was in some of the newspapers this week, that that would be subject to a probationary period. So there would be a period when you get hired, when you are going to get your sickness and maternity rights, but you are on probation, and that your full unfair dismissal rights don't come until a later stage when you've gone through that probationary period. And what they're thinking, I would guess, is if you don't do that, and people think if I hire somebody and they are the wrong person after a week, I can't get rid of them, that is a real blight on hiring in the first place, and they don't want to do that. So rights from day one, I think the probationary period is quite a significant caveat, and that's something to watch over the coming months.
Now, by the way, while Rachel's been setting this out, Jeremy, current occupant of number 11, we should just note, had quite an interesting spat with James Dyson, it was reported. So James Dyson, if there's been an advocate of a more interventionist economic policy over recent years, it's James Dyson. I've had many meetings with him when I was Chancellor, and I helped remove the obstacles that enabled him to buy a disused RAF airfield very near his factory in Malmesbury so that he could develop a British electric car. So I've had lots of dealings with him, and he was always an advocate for a more interventionist government.
How did you find your meetings with him?
Well, he's a very impressive man
because he's quite cantankerous.
He took me for a ride in his very impressive Rolls Royce once. I can tell you that. I was quite taken aback by the scale and the luxury.
And also, for somebody who is a big Brexiteer who wants lots of deregulation, when you meet him, it turns out he wants quite a lot of regulation.
I was a bit disappointed, obviously, by his vote on Brexit, which I thought, like a lot of these industry people who backed it. Anyway,
I was interrupting you. Jeremy Hunt.
Jeremy Hunt said to him, you know, I've had enough of your complaining. If you don't like the way we're running the economy, why didn't you stand for election yourself? Did you ever, certainly not with James, but with some other business people. I do remember sometimes sitting in these meetings and they were complaining about this, that, and the other. And I thought, oh, but, you know,
I know.
Why don't you try this job? Why don't you actually try and get elected and see what all the pressures on the people doing these jobs is really like?
I thought what was interesting is that Jeremy Hunt not only lost his rag in the meeting, which I've done before, but then it appeared in the newspapers. So he obviously decided, sod it, I'm going to say it.
I'm not sure you would have been so happy that being in the newspaper. Anyway, we should come back and discuss after this break a real job creation scheme, which would be, how about reintroducing conscription? How about getting everyone at some point in their life to join one of the armed services?
So we're going to talk about something you may have missed in the last few weeks, which is a number of voices, including most recently the Latvian foreign minister at the weekend in an interview with the Sunday Telegraph, talking about whether Britain should reintroduce conscription. Young people, 18, 19, 20-year-old, being required to sign up for the armed forces in order to discourage Russia's continued invasion of Ukraine, but also to deter them more widely from looking at other targets across the east of Europe.
I mean, this is a pretty kind of extraordinary conversation, even for us to be having. The very idea you could reintroduce conscription. I'm not talking, by the way, about all those various efforts, like David Cameron had something called National Citizen Service, or the sort of Duke of Edinburgh Awards are about, you know, trying to get people from different backgrounds together and trying to instill a sense of community spirit.
Hugely popular. Gordon Brown was always obsessed by that too.
Yes, there's a kind of big, you know, political prize out there, people think.
Super scout troops.
Let's make everyone a Boy Scout for a bit. Or a girl guide. Or I think, you know, a female scout, we should say. I think that's also an option these days. But this is, we're talking about saying...
George, you're in a hole. Get out of it.
Right. Well, I would know how to get out of it if I'd been on, done my national service, you see. And, you know, we're talking about this for defence reasons, not for any kind of social cohesion reasons. But a large number of European countries do still have conscription. And a number of British generals have been talking about it being reintroduced here in some form. There was one general who I heard on the radio.
General Patrick Sanders.
General Patrick Sanders saying, whilst professional armies start wars, it's conscription armies that end them. And that's a pretty chilling comment about, you know, of course, the history of the 20th century and Britain's involvement in the world wars, where a professional army starts fighting it and a conscript army ends up fighting it. But someone who I really rate, actually, and someone who I know personally, General Sheriff, Richard Sheriff, he was the Deputy Supreme Commander of Allied Forces Europe under NATO. And he actually took me for a day on a tour of the Battle of Waterloo, just outside Brussels. And it was one of the best days I had as Chancellor. You know, there wasn't much to do with the Treasury there, but it was. I was waiting for a Finance Minister's conference, and Richard took me around the battlefields, explained, you know, where the squares had been formed and the Hougoumont Chateau that had been defended. Anyway, he's a very sensible, very intelligent man. He's not some crazed right-wing military nut at all. And he is talking seriously about conscript armies. And normally professional soldiers hate the idea of conscript armies. But is the Russian threat so serious that we should be thinking about this? Is this something that is really ever going to be on the agenda?
I have to say, until we decided to talk about this, I had never realised, if you actually look through, not every country kind of fully enforces it in a compulsory way, but the Netherlands, Austria, Denmark, Switzerland, Finland, Norway, Lithuania, Estonia, they all have forms of conscription. We got rid of conscription in essentially between 1957 and 1960. We've never returned to it. And as you know, lost my seat in 2015, went back to Harvard, and I'd not been in Harvard for 30 years. And one of the things you do when you have that kind of return to a place is you think back to the assumptions I had when I was a young student in the late 1980s, which shaped your view of the world. And I realised there were certain assumptions I had about how the world would work, which I just believed, which turned out to be untrue. One of them, by the way, was that globalisation would be about money and then about product markets, about companies moving production. Nobody at that time was talking about the movement of people as being, you know, a big globalisation factor in the late 80s into the 90s. Nobody was talking actually about the rise of China as an economic force. So when I went back to Harvard in 2015, talking to these young students, I said to them, you should always challenge the assumptions you believe to be true, the things you are sure are going to last. And to do that, you've got to write them down. And I didn't do this 30 years ago, and I wish I had, because you're always looking for uncertainty, but it's the certainty which can kill you. And I got them to write down their assumptions about how the world would be. And I remember this so well in this meeting in 2016 with 30 Harvard students. And somebody said, we will never be conscripted to fight in a war in the way that our grandfathers were conscripted. And everybody just nodded. And it was just, it was obvious in 2016. Well, of course, that's an assumption. You know, people in Britain, they were mainly British students, are not going to be conscripted to fight a global war as happened in the First World War and the Second World War. And that's an assumption which suddenly, for the first time in my lifetime, looks in doubt. And it tells you that exercise of challenging yourself to challenge your certainties is as important as challenging uncertainty and what you don't know about. I still can't quite believe it's going to happen. And let's be honest, there'd be a riot. If you look at the opinion polls, a large minority of young people, if asked, would say that they wouldn't agree to be conscripted. Of course, in the Second World War, you had tribunals, conscientious objectors in the First World War as well. But, you know, and you might have to have a civilian alternative, but, you know, is it a realistic prospect that we could say to the 20-somethings of the next 5 years, you are going to have to sign up?
Well, I think it is at least a possibility. I mean, you probably get at the moment a hybrid, which is a much larger reserve force, and the re-establishment of all those sort of school and university cadet forces. The Eton Rifles, if you remember that song by the Jam.
Were you a member of the Combined Cadet Force?
We didn't have it at my school. It had been got rid of.
Did you?
I mean, it did used to exist, but it was got rid of, I guess.
Why was it got rid of?
We'd be fighting a war.
Surely Eton had a CCF.
I was not at Eton.
Weren't you?
As you well know. No, I see it's all an elaborate... Did you learn that on one of these... That's what we teach soldiers, like lead people into traps and ambushes. Anyway, it's a serious subject, not least because...
The Etonians never thought you were really proper, did they? It'd not been in the CCF.
I thought the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton. Anyway, we should... After this unnecessary diversion. That's another military term, isn't it? No, look, we should get back to the real issue, which is the threat from Russia is serious. If Donald Trump becomes the president, there's at least a question mark over ongoing American support for European security. President Macron last week has really weighed in on this. And is Britain ready as a society? I think we pose the question. We don't propose to give you the definitive answer, but it's obviously something we will go on talking about.
And it goes to the conversation we had a moment ago about Securenomics, which is, you know, it's one thing to want to strengthen your industrial base, and it may be one thing to invest in long-term new technologies. But actually, if you look at the kind of conversations which are now happening in the military defence world, they're saying, look, if you've not got the people, and you've not got the trained people, and you've not got the ammunition, then if there is suddenly a threat, are you ready? And actually, maybe that Securenomics is going to mean more munitions factories, building the munitions ready for something happening quickly rather than, you know, long-term technological innovation for some future war. It may be a rearming of Britain as we raise defence as a percentage of GDP will be, you know, part of the growth plan of the next 5 years.
Maybe we should ask the question, how many drones are actually made in Britain? Probably none at the moment. Very interesting topic. We will come back to it and this whole...
And did you like my reflection upon challenging your assumptions?
Yes, I did, actually. I thought it was a good test, isn't it? What are the things you assume are never going to change in our world? And then they do. And quite a lot has changed over recent years, hasn't it? We certainly would never have predicted when we face each other that we'd be out of the EU, there'd be a war in Europe... The American president would talk about leaving NATO.
And I would end up doing a podcast with George Osborne. My assumption was never. It's amazing what can surprise you.
Yeah.
And on that note, you need to go and chair the British Museum meeting.
You need to go and chair the British Museum board. That endures whatever happens. The British Museum.
Go and find the artifacts.
The British Museum will be here in hundreds of years' time. So thank you very much for listening this week. We will be back on Monday with EMQs, Ex-Minister's Questions, where we answer your questions, and then back next Thursday with our regular podcast.
And don't forget, you can send your questions to questions@politicalcurrency.co.uk. See you soon.
See you then.
Thanks for listening to Political Currency. This has been a Persephonica production.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.